Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. First on this week's program, Arizona politics TikTok queen Annalise Ortiz calls ban bad precedent. This story was written by TJ LeHeroux and was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on January 18th. With the U.S. Supreme Court upholding a law banning TikTok, the possibility of the popular app's demise across the country is becoming more real by the minute. Without intervention from Congress or incoming President Donald Trump, the ban will take effect January 19th. That could mean that one of Arizona's most proficient and informative accounts, the one belonging to Democratic State Senator Annalise Ortiz, will go dark. She's not happy about it. "I think it's incredibly disappointing," Ortiz told Phoenix New Times. "I think it sets a bad precedent going forward when it comes to free speech and what the government is censoring." TikTok took off during the coronavirus pandemic as an irreverent place for Gen Z kids to post videos of choreographed dances. Now, the entire internet, including roughly 170 million Americans, uses it for a wide range of purposes. Like many others, Ortiz started using TikTok to connect during the dark times at the beginning of the pandemic. But when she launched her campaign for the Arizona House of Representatives in 2022, Ortiz utilized TikTok to get the word out about her campaign and priorities. She now has nearly 48,000 followers, for whom she shines a light on what happens in state government. Her top post generated 1.2 million views, and others routinely attract hundreds of thousands. In May, Ortiz's TikTok page was noted by New Times as one of the top political accounts to follow on social media. It by far has not only been the most effective at getting out information about the business we do at the Capitol, but it also spreads that message to a very diverse audience, Ortiz said. "I've had people from all across the valley of all ages who recognize me in public because of TikTok and thank me for lifting the veil on the state capitol." A communications professional by trade, Ortiz has a unique insight into how losing TikTok will affect content creators and businesses in Arizona and beyond. To her, using the app is a simpler and more effective way to reach an intended audience than on other platforms like Facebook, Instagram, or X. In addition to her concerns about the ban limiting speech, Ortiz said she worries for small business owners who grow and expand their businesses using TikTok who are now going to be at a loss of income. "There's something about the TikTok algorithm that makes it more effective to reach people who are interested in your content," Ortiz said. "While with other social media platforms, it's almost as if you have to seek them out and put in much more effort toward finding and following the people who are going to care about what you have to say." Congress passed and President Joe Biden signed the ban to address concerns about the China-based app helping a foreign adversary spy on Americans through the data it collects. Under the law, TikTok may continue to operate in the U.S. if it's sold to an American company. But such a transaction is impossible with one day until the ban takes effect. For people looking to use social media to communicate, losing TikTok would leave them with few options. There is X, owned by Elon Musk, and Instagram and Facebook, both owned by Meta and Mark Zuckerberg. X has already devolved into a right-wing echo chamber, while Meta announced that it's ending its fact-checking program as Trump retakes the White House, abandoning all attempts to rein in the global political chaos that Facebook played a role in creating. Ortiz finds none of those options particularly appealing. "You see these two kind of tech bro oligarchs that are now going to have even more power. And with that comes the censorship of content towards a very narrow political view," Ortiz said. "And that really should be something that scares Americans." That sentiment was recently summed up in a column by The Guardian's Rebecca Shaw. It is entitled, "I knew one day I'd have to watch powerful men burn the world down. I just didn't expect them to be such losers." If the days of TikTok are indeed numbered, Ortiz will lose a major audience. But anyone interested can still follow her on other platforms. In a recent TikTok post, one user asked where she'd be going. Ortiz's reply was simple. The only places left. "Find me on IG, FB, and X," she wrote. At S-E-N, Annalise Ortiz. Next, a story written by TJ LeHoux and posted on January 17th. Ex-cops pulled gun pranks, stole gun from scene of a traffic fatality. If screenwriters need material for another Super Troopers sequel, they might want to look into the Gila River Police Department. On Wednesday, the Arizona Peace Officer Standards and Training Board, known as ASPOST, opened investigations into three former Gila River cops whose transgressions make for quite the rap sheet. One cop was busted for drunkenly driving an all-terrain vehicle through a park with kids around. Two others committed a litany of infractions, including pointing their firearms at each other as a joke. ASPOST licenses all law enforcement officers in the state and is one of the few agencies in Arizona with the power to discipline police. The board's principal task is certifying all officers across the state, but it also has the power to revoke or suspend the certifications of officers who demonstrate troubling behavior. The 12-member board includes Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays, two rural sheriffs, Phoenix City Council member Kevin Robinson, and Ryan Thornell, director of the Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry. In 2024, ASPOST opened 48 investigations into officers and punished 43 cops, including for putting the muzzle of a gun to a woman's head, asking two high school girls when they lost their virginity, driving while under the influence, lying to supervisors or investigators, and needlessly handcuffing an 82-year-old lady. During the board's first meeting of 2025, it punished four current and former law enforcement officers from across Arizona, while opening investigations into six others. Here are the notable developments from the meeting. Gila River Bad Boys. The three former Gila River officers the board decided to investigate, Matthew Evanson, Orlando Ramirez, and Zachary Torriente, all either resigned or were fired in 2024 for various reasons. Ramirez was arrested on June 10th for DUI and reckless driving when he drove an ATV onto a basketball court and volleyball court at a community park while children were occupying the area, according to ASPOST compliance specialist Michelle Blanco. He also drove over sidewalks and ran into some bushes before he got stuck in a sand volleyball court, according to witnesses who followed him home. At home, Ramirez was questioned by officers and registered a blood alcohol level of 0.248, three times the legal limit. He was fired a few weeks later. On September 12th, he agreed to a plea for one count of reckless driving. Evanson and Torriente made something of a tag team of misconduct. They somewhat frequently pointed guns at each other, and in at least one instance, Torriente pointed his gun at Evanson, took a picture, and sent it to Evanson. Cochise County Sheriff and ASPOST Chair Mark Daniels said it was alarming that the gun issue was not investigated criminally. Torriente also tested positive at work for marijuana and stole a gun from the scene of a traffic fatality he investigated, according to the department. He was fired on August 8th. Evanson was caught lying about when he was working and about conducting traffic stops. He resigned in July. Never mind, For 50 minutes, the board debated whether it made an error in suspending a Greenlee County Sheriff's deputy over a domestic violence incident, only for the debate to become moot when the deputy's lawyer withdrew his appeal. At a testy October meeting, the board suspended Deputy Thomas Montoya for 5 months over a May 2022 incident with his wife. According to an administrative judge's decision read at the meeting by Assistant Attorney General Mark Brachtel, Montoya threw a plate of food and pushed over a chair, reached out and grabbed his wife by the neck with both hands, and shoved her into a kitchen countertop. Though prosecuted for domestic violence and disorderly conduct, the local county attorney instead required Montoya to participate in educational counseling. Aspost usually punishes domestic violence incidents with a 2-year suspension by the board, but let Montoya off with a lighter penalty in October. Still, Montoya and lawyer Steven Cerbalik requested a rehearing, claiming the board's decision was unfairly made because it received a packet that contained inflammatory, unproven allegations against Montoya that the deputy had not been able to review. The well was effectively poisoned, Cerbalik said Wednesday. And to be clear, that was no fault of the board. Brachtel agreed that providing that packet to the board had been a mistake, but he argued that many of the board members did not read it, and that most said it did not factor into their decision. Several board members also told Cerbalik that they felt that Montoya's punishment might have been too lenient. "I listened to the tape very carefully on the second go-around," board member Lisa Wise told Cerbalik. "I heard several of the board members very clearly say that domestic violence is an automatic termination, and that's my concern for Mr. Montoya going forward." Mesa Police Chief Ken Cost, who wasn't on the board when Montoya was suspended, agreed that the 5-month suspension was not long enough. Montoya, who has already served the majority of his suspension, was also in the room but did not address the board. The board then went into executive session to discuss its legal options, only for Montoya to withdraw his appeal. "The hope that my client and I have is what we said before, that this is the catalyst for change and that due process happens in the future," Cerbalik said. Lying about what? Strangely, former Phoenix police officer Brian Salazar received a more severe punishment from the board than Montoya had. Salazar had his certificate retroactively suspended for 6 months for lying about an injury. In October 2023, a superior noticed Salazar had a healed laceration on his head. Salazar claimed that he hit his head on a rock while hiking, according to Assistant Attorney General Joe Dilo. The next day, Salazar requested to meet with that superior and confessed he had actually tripped on a laundry basket and hit his head on a piece of furniture at home. He added that he was embarrassed about how he got hurt. 3 weeks after that weird lie, Salazar resigned. The board received notice of the case only because Salazar quit. Other punishments. Former Tempe police officer Adam Shipley caught a retroactive 12-month suspension for an extreme DUI while he was driving off-duty in December 2022. He resigned from the department on January 10, 2024. Former Tohono O'odham Nation officer Melvin Secundino landed a certification denial for 3 years. Secundino was an academy recruit in August of 2024 when he was stopped by an Arizona Department of Public Safety patrol officer for using a suspended license plate. Secundino then lied about having car insurance, fessing up only when DPS officers said that they'd call the insurance company. Aspost Executive Director Matt Giordano also told Phoenix New Times the board is likely to rehear the case of former Peoria police officer Alice Belandis in February. In October, the board revoked Belandis' certification after she lied to investigators about a romantic relationship with a colleague who was investigating her conduct. Phoenix Representative Yasemin Ansari says she's skipping Trump's inauguration. This next story was written by Morgan Fisher and posted on January 16th. Donald Trump will be sworn in as president on Monday. Democratic Representative Yasemin Ansari has other places to be. An estimated 250,000 people will be on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. on Monday, as Trump officially retakes the White House, according to Reuters. Ansari won't be one of them, with the freshman representative announcing Thursday that she'll skip out on Trump's second inauguration to attend Martin Luther King Day events in Arizona instead. Third District families sent me to D.C. to work for them. That's why I'll be in my community this weekend, meeting with Arizonans and volunteering alongside the folks I represent, Ansari said in a statement. I fully support a peaceful transition of power and look forward to finding ways to reach across the aisle and work with my colleagues on ways to better the lives of Arizona families. Ansari's absence isn't about Trump, at least if her statement is to be believed. But it's worth noting that of the four Democrats in Arizona's congressional delegation, including the newest, having won her Democratic primary by just 39 votes before sailing to a win in November, she's the one who's demonstrated the most backbone in opposing Trump's policy aims. Representative Greg Stanton, Senator Mark Kelly, and especially Senator Ruben Gallego has signaled that they're willing to play ball with Trump on his hardline deportation goals. Gallego co-sponsored the GOP's Lake and Riley Act, which would deport undocumented immigrants without due process if they were arrested for crimes as minor as shoplifting. Stanton helped that bill pass the House, while Kelly voted to advance it in the Senate. The 32-year-old Ansari was the only Arizona Democrat to outright oppose it, calling the bill a gross miscarriage of justice that will do nothing to prevent this kind of violence or reform our broken immigrant system. Ansari won't be the only one missing out on Trump's inauguration. Former First Lady Michelle Obama also won't be there, though she's given no reason for her absence. It's worth noting that neither Trump nor his wife Melania attended Joe Biden's inauguration. Additionally, Ansari's House colleague, former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, announced that she won't attend. If Ansari is truly skipping because of a love for MLK Day, she'll have several events to fill her time. MLK Day events in Ansari's district include the Arizona Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Celebration Committee's commemorative march at East Lake Park, and a festival at Margaret T. Hance Park. The program continues with this story written by T.J. LeHeroux and posted on January 15th. Deflated. State Senator kills bill to ban unlawful release of balloons. A bill to prohibit the unlawful release of balloons has popped. State Senator John Kavanaugh, a Republican representing Scottsdale, is abandoning Senate Bill 1004, which he introduced in December before it became the butt of jokes. The bill would have made it a petty offense to intentionally release 10 or more balloons into the air, resulting in a fine for offenders. After introducing the bill, Kavanaugh realized that it would actually lower the penalty for releasing balloons, which is already considered littering and a misdemeanor. Whoops. Kavanaugh said he told the office of Arizona House Speaker Steve Montenegro not to assign the bill to a committee, which will bring it to a natural death in this session. The whole thing was an entire calamity of unintended outcomes, Kavanaugh told Phoenix New Times. I knew it was going nowhere with the jokes and the humor and lowering the penalty. It needs more work. Kavanaugh said that the idea for the bill came from an email from, quote, some group in California. It mentioned that California cattle ranchers supported the bill because cattle were dying from eating fallen balloons in their fields. That was one reason Kavanaugh thought that it could get passed in Arizona. It seemed like a good idea at the time, he said. But the problem with the bill is that releasing balloons is littering and already a misdemeanor, though Kavanaugh noted that littering is nearly impossible to enforce when it comes to balloons. A police officer couldn't cite you until the officer saw the balloon hit the ground, Kavanaugh said, which is not going to happen. Kavanaugh has considered making changes to the bill, specifically making it a presumption in law that anyone who releases a balloon isn't going to retrieve it when it lands. A person could override the presumption by proving that they had a way to retrieve the balloon, Kavanaugh said. He added that he still wants to talk to lawyers about that idea. While his bill would have lowered the penalty for releasing balloons, the calamity of unintended outcomes brought about other epiphanies for Kavanaugh. It did not bring to my attention the absurdity of making people criminals for dropping gum wrappers on the ground, he said. He plans to introduce a bill this session to lower the penalty for small littering from a misdemeanor to a petty offense, a reasonable thing to do that Democrats might support. I originally made the balloon bill penalty a petty offense because I didn't want the Democrats to go south and accuse me of creating the balloon-to-prison pipeline, Kavanaugh joked. That joke might need some work, too. Misdemeanors are not punishable by prison time. Next, a story written by Matthew Bird and posted on January 15th. Arizona Pet Store sells sick dogs with predatory loans, customers say. After she was diagnosed with brain cancer, Rachel Duffel was looking for a medical alert dog. In August 2023, the Queen Creek resident found one at Puppyland, a pet store in Tolleson. Puppyland, a chain with two locations in Arizona and more in Texas, Idaho, and Washington, provided clean medical records for the dog, a 10-week-old Cavalier King Charles Spaniel, the Duffel named Archie Stiles. Archie Stiles also came with a warranty, an additional protection to put Duffel's mind and pocketbook at ease. Things with Archie Stiles have not gone as hoped, however. The dog wound up costing Duffel thousands of dollars in medical expenses, she said, which she'd had to fight Puppyland to recover. While Duffel's prognosis is promising, after surgery and recovery, her last MRI showed no new tumors in her brain, the dog has continued to fight malady after malady. Archie Stiles became nearly immobile and unable to serve as a medical alert dog. Veterinarians told Duffel that Archie likely had morbidly deformed back legs due to a genetic condition, according to records Duffel provided to Phoenix New Times. Medical expenses for the dog cost Duffel more than $7,000 in vet bills in just a few months. He's such a sweet, loving dog, and it's not his fault that they're inbreeding and hurting these puppies, Duffel said, holding back tears. What do I do? I committed myself to this dog, and I have to try to get him a better life. Duffel blames Puppyland, and she isn't the only past customer with a grudge against the store. Other Arizona pet owners who purchased dogs from Puppyland reported similar issues to New Times. They criticized the poor health of the animals Puppyland sells, the chain's Byzantine warranty claim process, and a predatory loan arrangement that saddles pet owners with interest rates as high as 199%, the latter putting the pet store chain in the crosshairs of regulators in Washington state, though such loans remain legal in Arizona. Kayla Kerr, a co-owner of the Puppyland chain, denied any wrongdoing to Phoenix New Times. She said the chain provides payment plans to make purchasing a dog more accessible. Kerr added that warranty claims that are properly submitted according to contract instructions are paid out in full. How much plus interest for that doggy in the window? Kerr said that she started Puppyland to innovate the industry and to give owners a trusted place to buy dogs. Puppyland debuted its first store in Washington in 2018. It opened its Tolleson store in 2022 and a second location in Chandler last year. On its website, the company describes itself as a pet store that offers purebred and designer breeds for sale with health guarantees. The Tolleson location seems attractive enough, with 4.8 stars on Google. But the Better Business Bureau gives it an F rating. One reason why? The chain pushes high-interest loans on customers. Jenny Lunning purchased a French Bulldog from Puppyland in 2023. She said she sought out the loan. The dog cost $5,000, which Lunning said is normal for that breed. But she was still shocked by how they pushed it on her and how much it ultimately cost. After the loan and everything, he ended up being closer to $7,000, she said. So we were caught off guard with that. Lunning pays $147.25 each month with a 49% interest rate on the lower end of the rate range listed in Puppyland's contracts. Based on her payment plan, she said it would take another 3 years to pay off the loan, though she intends to do so sooner. About half of her monthly payments go to the loan principal. The rest is paying off the interest. Duffel said that the Puppyland sales associates also tried to get her to take out a loan. She repeatedly told them no, but they persisted. She held them off, paying for her puppy with cash and her credit card. High-interest pet loans are not uncommon in the industry, though Puppylands have earned scrutiny. Kerr notes that the loans are provided not by Puppyland, but instead by third-party lenders, Lending USA, EasyPay Finance, and Cordova Financial. "We don't have any control over what terms and rates they offer," she said. At least two of the lenders, EasyPay and Cordova, have pockmarks in their histories. Last year, Massachusetts Attorney General Andrea Campbell called EasyPay Finance loans predatory, and reached an agreement with the company that it would stop operating in the state. Cordova Financial, which primarily provides loans for guns and has Donald Trump Jr. on its parent company's board, according to SEC filings, is facing penalties from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It also was fined $50,000 by the California Department of Financial Protection and Innovation for its use of hidden fees. Puppyland ran into its own legal issues over the loans in Washington State. In 2023, Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson sued Puppyland for channeling consumers into predatory loans. The state alleged that Puppyland employees were rushing consumers into signing up for loans without giving them time to comprehend its terms. According to the lawsuit, Puppyland sold a $5,900 dog to an 18-year-old who worked part-time at restaurants. Puppyland signed her up for two loans, yet did not explain the loan terms or financial implications of stacking two loans, the suit said. The two loans carried interest rates of 81% and 128%. Loan payments plus vet bills and other expenses were the equivalent of nearly 2 weeks of the woman's salary, per the suit. She lost her apartment as a result and was forced to live in a car with her puppy, the suit said. The company settled with the state in early 2023, not long before Washington Governor Jay Inslee signed a law banning financing for pets. The law also requires that puppies remain with their mother until 8 weeks of age, businesses to include prices and breeder information on advertisements, and breeders to be licensed under the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Puppyland closed one of its locations in Washington and stopped offering puppy payments at its flagship store. Financing remains available at its two Arizona stores. "Most customers pay in full," Kerr said. "But for those that want to utilize financing options, they have access to their terms and rates to decide if they want to go through with the contract." On January 2nd, after Kerr spoke to New Times, the Tacoma News Tribune reported that Puppyland had settled another lawsuit. The suit was brought by a woman who said that she was pushed to take out a loan for $6,000 to pay for a Dutch hound that died roughly a month after she bought it. Kerr had previously said the woman's claims were false. Sick puppies. For 40 to 50 years, pet stores have been shady, Kerr said. She aims to change that. Kerr said Puppyland works to ensure the dogs it sells are healthy. It works exclusively with responsible and licensed hobby breeders, she said. And she and her team visit breeders from whom they purchase dogs. To increase transparency for pet buyers, Kerr's stores feature TVs that play videos of breeding facilities that she and her videographer filmed. She pushes her breeders to perform genetic testing to identify potential diseases in puppies. Kerr said only a small number of puppies arrive at the store with illnesses. When sick dogs do arrive, Puppyland keeps them in special isolation rooms. Veterinarians check the dogs at least twice before families take the animals home, in compliance with Arizona law. Puppyland's contracts include warranty protections. The company will reimburse customers up to 100% of the cost of the dog for vet visits related to viral infections contracted within 15 days of purchase. Customers also can get reimbursed for the value of their dog if a genetic disease or birth defect is identified within 2 years. Puppyland also offers a 10-year warranty that covers 50% of the cost of a new puppy if the first puppy dies from a life-altering congenital or hereditary condition diagnosed by a licensed veterinarian. In the long run, Kerr said, it's more cost-effective to buy a warrantied puppy from her than to chance a cheaper one from somewhere else. You could buy a puppy for $700 in a parking lot, Kerr said, but you may end up paying thousands of dollars in vet bills. Meanwhile, some customers say it's agonizing to get the store to honor the warranties. When Duffel learned that her dog had a genetic issue, she knew her warranty covered congenital and hereditary issues discovered within 2 years of purchase. Yet, whenever she called Puppyland, the call never went through. She said that she eventually pursued legal mediation with Puppyland. Kerr disputes that, saying that no warranty cases have gone to mediation or arbitration. Eventually, Duffel said Puppyland reimbursed her $1,500 for her dog's medical bills. She still needed to take on 2 extra jobs to pay for her dog's medical debt and ongoing treatments, including physical therapy and surgery. Some owners said that using the warranty requires a lengthy process filled with red tape. The warranty contract says buyers must submit warranty claims at puppylandarizona.com, while a different handout given to customers directs them to submit claims to a third-party website. On that third-party site, they communicate with claim specialists who require documentation of the illness and vet bills. Lanning said that she filed a claim after her dog was diagnosed with parvo, a highly contagious and potentially deadly virus that affects dogs. She said she repeatedly emailed the company for months and threatened to sue Puppyland before the company finally reimbursed her for $200 of the $1,000 of out-of-pocket costs for the dog's medical bills. The warranty contract also states that when puppies die, owners have just 24 hours to notify the store before they forfeit their warranty. The contract of one customer, who bought a dog from Puppyland in August 2023, also states that the warranty is voided if a customer speaks negatively to, quote, compromise the goodwill, name, brand, or reputation, end quote, of Puppyland, including by leaving negative reviews or posting on social media. Kerr said that Puppyland no longer includes such language in the agreements that it presents to customers. When informed about the clause in the customer's contract, Kerr said Puppyland had removed that provision during the past few weeks. She added that Puppyland had never enforced the clause, which she'd included because her veterinarian had been harassed and Kerr had received death threats. Despite the $1,500 reimbursement from Puppyland, Duffel is saving up for a second knee surgery for her dog, which is still in physical therapy. For now, she is hoping Puppyland will be held accountable. "I really hope this place gets shut down," she said. "I have thousands and thousands of dollars in vet bills because I was sold a dog that I was told was purebred and not from a puppy mill. But it was all lies." Mark Kelly grills Trump cabinet pick on being a sloppy drunk. The Arizona senator questioned Department of Defense nominee Pete Hegseth about his history of getting blitzed off his ass. The story was written by Morgan Fisher and was posted on January 14th. After that, Pete Hegseth might need a drink. On Tuesday, the Senate Armed Services Committee began its confirmation hearing for Hegseth, President-elect Donald Trump's problematic choice to run the Department of Defense. Hegseth has military experience, but has never run a large organization, and faces allegations of sexual harassment, rampant misogyny, alcohol abuse, and public intoxication. In theory, the hearing is a chance for senators to vet the credentials of the person tabbed to oversee the U.S. military, and a budget of more than $850 billion. In practice, it's political theater. Most senators already know how they'll vote. Arizona Senator Mark Kelly is no exception, which is why the Democrat already had an anti-Hegseth op-ed ready to promote before the hearing began. But that didn't stop him from putting the screws to the former Fox News host, mostly over Hegseth's sordid history of getting absolutely and inappropriately drunk off his ass. For 7 minutes, the Air Force veteran and former astronaut pestered Hegseth to confirm or deny the myriad reports of his drunkenness. After most answers, Hegseth managed a non-answer. Anonymous smears. A good name for a cocktail, perhaps, but not a convincing response. Did you once pass out in the back of a party bus? Kelly wasn't stingy with the dirty details, even if Hegseth was less than forthcoming in his answers. The Arizona senator outlined the scope of Hegseth's drinking problem, referencing allegations reported by The New Yorker in early December. When Hegseth was the president of Concerned Veterans of America, was he carried out of a 2014 Memorial Day event in Virginia? True or false? Anonymous smears, Hegseth replied. Just true or false. Very simple, Kelly reiterated. Was Hegseth drunk at a CVA event in Cleveland that same year? What about during an event in North Carolina or at a CVA Christmas party in Washington, D.C.? Was it true or false that he had to be carried to his room? What about the party bus? The party bus! Each time the answer was the same. Anonymous smears. Kelly continued. Did Hegseth take staffers, including young female employees, to a strip club in Louisiana in 2014? Finally, Hegseth answered definitively. Absolutely not, he said, although he tossed in another anonymous smears for unintentional comic effect. At the end of his grill session, Kelly acknowledged the obvious. It'll be a no on Hegseth from the senior senator from Arizona. You say that you have had personal issues in your past, yet, when asked about those very issues, you blame an anonymous smear campaign. Even when many of these claims are not anonymous, Kelly said. Which is it? Have you overcome personal issues? Or are you the target of a smear campaign? It can't be both. It is clear to me that you are not being honest with us or the American people because you know the truth would disqualify you from getting the job, Kelly added. If Hegseth didn't have a hangover already, that hearing might have given him one. Writer T.J. LeHeroux brings us this next story that was posted on January 14th. Tempe officials bashed Anti-Coyotes Arena cave people in secret meeting. Editor's note, this story was updated to include comments from Tempe spokesperson Chris Baxter-Ging. When they think nobody's listening, Tempe officials don't seem to have qualms about mocking their constituents. The Tempe City Council assumed it was protected from prying ears when it went into a closed-door meeting on December 15, 2022. According to the minutes from the meeting, council members needed secrecy to discuss their personal observations of Tempe residents conveying support for a new arena for the Arizona Coyotes. What the council members and Mayor Corey Woods actually said was a bit more colorful than that. According to an audio recording of the meeting, the officials used their shroud of secrecy to disparage area opponents. Citizens who campaigned against the arena were, quote, cave people, while arena opposition ringleader Ron Tapscott was a crazy uncle. The city released the tape on January 10th in response to a public records request from Tempe resident Mario Martinez, who then shared it with New Times. Despite the dismissive monikers, the crazy uncle and the cave people ultimately won. In May 2023, Tempe voters handily rejected a ballot referendum to support a new home for the Coyotes, who has since moved to Utah. The recording became public because, essentially, it should have been public all along. In October, the Arizona Attorney General found that the Tempe City Council broke the law by holding three executive session meetings that the public was barred from observing. During those meetings, the council discussed the secret monitoring of a social media backlash to the arena proposal. As a result, the city has been forced to cough up tapes from those meetings. Only the December 15th meeting was recorded, according to Tempe City Attorney Eric Anderson and city spokesperson Chris Baxter Ging. The tape released contains just the portion of the meeting that violated public law. Baxter Ging said that the other two illegal meetings, on November 3rd and November 22nd of that year, weren't recorded because e-sessions are typically not recorded. The clerk in the December 15th session was filling in for the city clerk and recorded the meeting to maintain better minutes as it was her first time filling in. What was said in the other two illegal meetings, and who else Tempe officials might have belittled behind closed doors, remains a mystery. Arizona's open meetings law requires that the public's business be done in public, said John Riches, the vice president of litigation for the Goldwater Institute, a libertarian think tank. The city of Tempe should not and legally cannot hide public activities by discussing this sort of information behind closed doors. This is especially troubling because the city used taxpayer funds to monitor and then secretly discuss citizens who were opposed to a controversial city proposal. Cave people. In the recording of the December 15th meeting, which Tempe officials held with consulting company Strategy 48, Woods and others vented their frustration with anti-arena activists. Woods harbored a particular disdain for Tapscott, whose Tempe First organization played a major role in whipping up opposition to the arena ballot measure. "Ron is your crazy uncle forwarding a chain letter," Woods said during the meeting. "I mean, at some point, people begin to tune you out because it just becomes, he won't stop ranting about it. It's like, oh my God, we know you don't like it. Just vote no in May and leave us alone." Woods did not respond to New Times inquiry. Tapscott could not be reached. In the tape, Strategy 48 consultant Troy Corder, referring to Tempe residents who were opposing the projects as folks who just like to yell at each other and cave people, which he explained was a belittling acronym. "We haven't seen where arena opposition has gotten to the normal folk," Corder said. "Right now, what we're seeing is just there's the typical, who I call cave people, citizens against virtually everything." "Yes, exactly," said Tempe Vice Mayor Jennifer Adams. Woods then called Tapscott our self-appointed emperor of cave, and noted that his posts were not receiving much engagement before dropping the crazy uncle comparison. Then Woods called on fellow council member Randy Keating. Council member Keating who I now owe royalties for using the Crazy Uncle line, so I'll have your checks in the mail, Woods said. Yeah, Keating retorted to raucous laughter from Woods. You can just Venmo me, man. For Greg Leslie, the executive director of the First Amendment Clinic at Arizona State University, Tempe's misuse of executive session is emblematic of a larger problem. Public officials nationwide have routinely ignored or misused the rules for executive sessions so that they can discuss something they want to keep secret, he said. But a general desire for secrecy isn't enough justification for going into executive session, Leslie added. It should be used when something must be kept confidential, he said, like to discuss legal advice. Not when you want to talk to a consultant who's been paid to track your opponents. The exemption is meant to be narrow and protect a true legal interest in confidentiality, Leslie said. It should never be a tool to promote secrecy, to get away with something that is definitely the public's business. A lot of money to be wrong. Despite having paid Strategy 48 to keep its finger on the pulse, the recording also revealed that some Tempe officials dramatically underestimated the current of opposition to the arena plan. Woods noted that he was concerned that some people who supported the project decided to be silent on social media to avoid arguments. Keating also seemed to believe that the plan enjoyed broad public support. I can say 100% of the people I've talked to are in support of the project, and it's not like I'm in my own echo chamber either, Keating said. He was. The echo chamber tends to portray like it has more gravity than it normally does. Keating did not respond to a request for comment. During an executive session meeting 2 months earlier, the council agreed to pay $10,000 a month to Strategy 48 to surveil and analyze social media activity related to the arena project. The council did not sign a formal contract with the consulting company, nor discuss the agreement publicly, which the Attorney General's office determined was legal. The council is not required to publicly approve any contracts less than $100,000. However, discussing the results of Strategy 48's social media monitoring in secret did violate the law. Tempe's council members were required to receive training on the open meeting law, according to the Attorney General's letter. That training, which was approved by the Attorney General's office, wound up being a 20-minute presentation from Anderson to the council on November 19th. Strategy 48's contract was for 6 months, but the agreement ended early in January 2023. According to the Attorney General, Tempe paid the company a total of $32,258 to surveil its citizens online. The open meetings violation cost Tempe nearly as much. According to invoices from the law firm Ballard Spahr, which represented Tempe in dealings with the Attorney General, Tempe paid more than $28,700 in legal fees. The invoices were released by the city attorney in response to a records request. In total, the council's decision to secretly monitor social media wound up costing taxpayers $61,000. Rachel Mitchell's fiancé called the cops on us for doing journalism. A New Times reporter called Paul Stout, the Maricopa County attorney's beau, for comment in October. Stout dialed the police. This story was written by Stephen Lemons and was posted on January 13th. Hell hath no fury like Rachel Mitchell's fiancé, especially after a journalist calls him for a quote. In October, Phoenix New Times reported that Paul Stout had been using burner accounts on X to attack critics of Mitchell, his fiancé, and the current Maricopa County attorney. One of those critics was Vladimir Gadzik, a suspended attorney and a vociferous tweeter against whom Stout sought a protective order. Stout admitted to his use of the burner accounts and his relationship to Mitchell, which the county attorney has not discussed publicly, during a September hearing about the protective order. When I called Stout for a quote on the hearing, Stout apparently called the cops. That's how my name landed in an October 27th incident report from the Phoenix Police Department. The report, which is one of several police reports and supplements involving Stout and Gojek, says the 63-year-old Stout complained that I had retweeted Gojek on X and then called Stout to ask for an interview. New Times tried again to reach Stout for the story and, again, was unsuccessful. No word on whether he dialed 911. The soap opera between Stout and Gojek has been percolating for months and seemed like an online slap fight between two random guys until late last year. That's when Stout revealed his connection to Mitchell while under oath, raising questions about the involvement of the county's top law enforcement official. The apparent conflict of interest for Mitchell, who has been stung by one before, is obvious. When he made Gojek's tweets about Mitchell a police matter, Stout began a process that resulted in police submitting Gojek for charges to the county attorney. That would put Mitchell in a position of prosecuting Gojek, or journalists on whom Stout sicks the cops, for making her fiancé uncomfortable. Mitchell's office did not return a call seeking comment. So far, there is no indication that Mitchell has considered filing charges against Gojek. Nor is it clear whether she has referred the case to another prosecuting attorney, like another county attorney or the state attorney general. However, New Times has learned that she has filed a complaint with the State Bar of Arizona, in which she has asked them to disbar the hyper-online thorn in her side. Police? Someone's committing journalism. On August 22nd, Stout was granted an injunction against Gojek that stifled what the suspended attorney could say about or to him online, and in real life, although they've never met. According to police records, Stout spoke to police several times in August, September, and October to allege that the 50-year-old Gojek repeatedly violated the protective order. Gojek unsuccessfully challenged the injunction during a two-day hearing in September before Maricopa County Commissioner Richard Albrecht. The commissioner sided with Stout, finding that Gojek's insulting and sometimes vulgar posts were not protected by the First Amendment. During the hearing, Stout admitted under oath to using burner accounts on X to do battle with Gojek. New Times later reported that these same burner accounts were used to take swipes at Mitchell's political rivals, her critics, and Valley journalists, including New Times news editor Zach Buchanan. For the initial story on the feud, I called Stout to ask for comment. This is standard journalistic practice. Stout did not answer nor return the call. According to the police report, Stout instead contacted police, telling an officer that I had left a voicemail saying he wanted to interview him for a story, per the report. The police have never contacted me, though the report identifies me as a suspicious individual. Stout said that the phone call came not long after I had retweeted an October 27th post that mentioned Stout's name. The original tweet was posted by Vladimir Gojek, the report reads. It appears the post in question is a retweet of Gina Godbehere, Mitchell's challenger in the 2024 Republican primary. Godbehere was commenting on a May post from @AZ1Patriot, a now defunct account that was later revealed to be one of Stout's burners. The @AZ1Patriot post had responded to a Mother's Day message from Godbehere criticizing her overly too tight shirt. Gojek quote tweeted Stout's comment in September, calling it sexist. Godbehere then quote tweeted Gojek, noting that she'd learned the original quote creepy response had come from Stout. Godbehere tagged Mitchell on the post. I retweeted Godbehere's missive on October 27th, the same day Stout called the police to report an act of journalism. A conflict of interest. During the hearing before Albrecht in September, Stout testified that Mitchell helped him write the petition for an injunction against Gojek. Mitchell, also listed as a possible witness on Stout's behalf, was a no-show at the hearing. According to the police reports, Stout told investigators that Mitchell had a conversation with the assistant chief of police about Gojek, prompting police to open a case against the suspended attorney. Stout also told police the matter had been reported to the FBI and that he and Rachel would be interviewed by the FBI because the FBI felt there was cyberstalking. According to court records, Gojek was served with the injunction against harassment by FBI agent Wyatt Storm, who was accompanied by deputies from the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. In body cam footage from the Sheriff's Office posted online by Gojek, Storm tells Gojek that the injunction was sent to the FBI by Mitchell's office. The FBI's Phoenix office did not reply to an inquiry from New Times about whether it is investigating Gojek. Gojek's criticism of Stout online certainly wasn't tame. The Phoenix police report describes posts in which Gojek calls Stout a total pussy and a fucking loser, among other things, and challenges the former shoe salesman and retired state worker to confront me like a man, you fucking dipshit. Gojek also called Albrecht a fucking commie. At least one police officer seemed skeptical that Stout or Mitchell faced danger from Gojek. The officer wrote that Stout did not provide specific examples or elements of specific threats made toward him. Still, the police report states that the case was submitted to the Maricopa County Attorney's Office for review for possible prosecution of Gojek on charges of aggravated assault, a Class 6 felony. Mitchell's office did not reply to a request for comment on the possible conflict of interest inherent in deciding whether to prosecute a case wherein Mitchell's fiancé is the alleged victim. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Stay tuned for additional interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. Remember that if you missed any of the stories in this program or any other Sun Sounds program, you can listen to them on demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then click on On Demand Podcasts, scroll down to the program you're interested in, and click on Listen.